Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Om Shri Sai Ram. Offering myself at Bhagwan's lotus feet, this is Karuna along with audio engineer Yatharta welcoming you to Thursday Live. Welcome to Morning Glory, coming to you live from Prashanthinilayam, the spiritual capital of the universe. The time here at the Radio Sai Studios is 9:37 a.m. I'm starting just a few minutes early because of the content that I have lined up for you on Morning Glory today. By the way, today is Thursday, April the 4th, 2013, and you're tuned to Asia Stream on Radio Sai. Current weather conditions in Prashanthinilayam call for clear sunny skies, excellent air quality with zero pollution. The current temperature is at 30 degrees Celsius. We are nearly at the peak of the Puttaparthi summer right now. And afternoon temperatures here tend to generally go close to 39, 40 degrees these days. Here's what's making news in Prashanthi this morning. The ashram is gearing up for Ugadi celebrations for next Thursday, which is April the 11th. It is the new year for a number of communities across India that day, including the Telugu-speaking people here in Andhra Pradesh. As always, the program from the Mandir on Ugadi will be streamed live to you, and you can join us virtually from anywhere in the world. And there is a possibility that the Mandir program may stretch beyond 9:40 a.m. Indian Standard Time, which means it may spill into Morning Glory slot next week. So just in case we don't meet next week, here's a heads up. The Vidyagiri complex in Prashanthinilayam is on vacation. Swami students are now on their summer break and they are conspicuous by their absence in the Mandir. Having said that, there is quite a sizable population of Sai students whose home is right here in Puttaparthi as their parents work for the various Sai institutions such as the hospitals, the ashram, the schools and the colleges. And there's another large group of Sai alumni working here as well. So the Vedam and the Bhajans are going on as beautifully as ever in the ashram. Prashanthinilayam continues to play host to an international community of seekers. Many of them come from the Christian world. The recent change of guard at the Vatican is an interesting development for the world, including the Sai community, which is possibly the largest and the quietest service-driven spiritual organization in the world at this point in human history. The March 13th election of the 266th and current Pope of the Catholic Church is so out of the box for a number of reasons. The 76-year-old Bishop of Rome, the head of the worldwide Catholic Church and sovereign of the Vatican City-State, was born in Latin America in Argentina. Many view Pope Francis's acts of humility, interfaith outlook, and his stress on loving all and serving all as a new chapter in the history of the Catholic Church. I thought this is an apt time to revisit an interview that was recorded in 2010 with Reverend Kieran Chenoweth of the USA. In this conversation, the Reverend spoke of her faith in Christ as the basis of her love for Sai. She touched upon several issues concerning her Christian background, the Church, and the Vatican. In light of the recent events at the Vatican, Reverend Kieran's insights assume added significance, which I hope you will enjoy. At the bottom of the hour, you will hear part 3 of the Fleeting Moments interview with Mr. Madhav Srimad Bhagavatam. Over now to a conversation with Reverend Kieran Chenoweth. Sai Ram, dear listeners, Radio Sai is pleased to welcome an American church minister, Reverend Kieran Chenoweth, to a conversation. Reverend Kieran Chenoweth was born in Columbus, Ohio, USA. From 4 years of age, she grew up in Laramie, Wyoming. In 1984, Kieran was ordained a church minister in Greeley, Colorado, USA, at the First Congregational United Church of Christ. In her ministry work, Kieran has served as a parish minister, a university minister, and a hospital chaplain. While serving the church as a minister, Reverend Kieran Chenoweth had the profound spiritual realization that the second coming that the scriptures speak of had already occurred, and that it was staring her in the face as love, as truth, and as bliss in the person of His divine worship, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. This startling truth and his open declaration cost Reverend Kiran Chenoweth her job at the church. She performed her last duties as a minister at the First Congregational Church in Wheatland, Wyoming, USA, on the Sunday after Easter in 2004. Today, she is no longer associated directly with the church, but her love for Christ continues to inspire her to serve others. As a counselor, she teaches self-help classes for women and various groups. Currently, she works as a Reiki master to assist the healing process in both people and animals. She composes music and sacred lyrics and is a poet, having written the book Soul Fire, Soul Desire. Sai Ram, Reverend Karen Chenoweth, and welcome to Radio Sai.
Sai Ram, I'm very pleased to be here, and I would like to directly give my love and thanks to our dear Lord, Swami Sai Baba, and of course to Radio Sai for having me here and the opportunity to share.
Well, let's start off with a quick recap of the cultural and spiritual background that you were born into.
I'm a citizen of the United States of America. I was born in Columbus, Ohio. My father was receiving his doctorate in psychology, and he was offered a job at the University of Wyoming. So he wanted to take his family back to Wyoming because both he and my mother were from Wyoming originally. So I grew up in this wonderful university town with lots of cultural activities, spiritual activities, and from the very beginning, the church was very important to me. My parents were very active. It was the Presbyterian Church, and I was very active. And I remember on Youth Sunday, if they ever wanted anybody to speak, I always raise my hand and say, yeah, I'd like to give the message for today. And I taught Bible school and Sunday school, and I was the president of our church group, and it was just such an important way for me to express my love for God. And I have to say, I came into this lifetime loving God immensely, and actually looking back, God, the presence of God, what that word meant to me as a small child, was the most real, concrete, tangible thing in my life. And I had a Bible storybook that my grandmother gave me, which was absolutely fantastic. I would look through there and I would just imagine, put myself back in those stories from both the Old and New Testament. And, you know, I could see myself walking along with Jesus and sitting at the bottom of the hill when he was giving his Beatitudes. And it was just, it was a wonderful experience. And, you know, to go out in nature and commune, because Wyoming is absolutely an incredible, beautiful place. And I would just sit on the rock, and God's presence was everywhere. I mean, I think I've known the experience of bliss, you know, it's kind of popped in and out here and there ever since I was little.
So it looks like your choice of your career as a minister was just a natural progression of your faith or your life experiences.
It actually was. Now, I think what's a bit amusing is that in the back of my mind, I really did want to be a minister, but I'll have to admit, I wasn't sure what my family and friends would think about that, you know. So we were driving by on I-25, which is a major thoroughfare of Denver, because I live in Broomfield, which is a suburb of Denver. And it was actually my husband. He says, you know, Karen, he said, you'd be really good. You ought to go to Iliff School of Theology, because there was a sign there. And immediately I could just feel this resonance in my heart. And so it was a difficult journey. I did sign up.
So you went to the school of theology after your marriage?
Yes, after my marriage.
Till then, what were you doing?
I had done a lot of things. I had actually been trained in education to be a teacher, to teach social science. So I had taught at a community college, the various self-help classes that I mentioned in there.
So from education, you shifted to theology?
I shifted to theology. And in a way, it was a very easy shift for me to make because the love and the spirituality was already there. And I was one of these people that loved to get up in front of people like a teacher has to and hopefully help the students, you know, grasp concepts and do things like that. So it was a real natural, but it was difficult because when I started seminary, I had two small children, and my second daughter, she was only 3 months old when I started, and I had to commute an hour each way, spend the whole day, come back, be a mother, you know, be a wife, and it took me about 5 years to complete the complete course, which is called the Masters of Divinity. Mm-hmm. And so that's...
And then you were ordained a minister in 1984.
Yes.
I see.
Yeah.
Then tell our listeners, when, why, and how were you drawn to Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba?
When I was drawn to Swami was actually in 1975. And I was living in Greeley, and there's a very lovely community called Fort Collins, which is probably 60 miles down the road. And I had a friend, that's all I remember at this point. She said, you know, they're doing this spiritual program at the community center. Why don't you come along? Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, great. So I went with her, and they were showing a video of Swami, an old one called Man of Miracles. Mm-hmm. And I probably sat there with my mouth open the entire time because in my heart I went, oh my. God's back on the planet. I mean, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that all that is creator, Brahman, whatever you want to call, you know, God was here in flesh and blood.
And just seeing that one video, you knew
just
it?
Just seeing that. I knew it. Mm-hmm. I knew it. But interestingly, I was quite young then, mm-hmm. and I had two small children, and I was married, and Swami actually didn't call me to come see his form until 1999, so I needed to do my dharma, my duty as a wife, as a mother, and be trained as a minister, I think, and do all those skills that I've learned along the way that I find, and I think it's true for a lot of individuals that I know, he takes those and broadens them and helps you build upon them. So public speaking, I sang in many choirs, I toured different places in the world with my music, all those things I had an opportunity to do.
So if I may interrupt here, mm-hmm. when you were ordained a minister,
yes.
you were already aware of Bhagwan's presence on earth.
Yes, I was.
But you hadn't physically received the gift of darshan by then.
No, I had not physically had the gift of darshan. But what did happen was I read a lot of books. And in these books, Swami's name, you know, continued to be mentioned. And, you know, sort of in the back of my mind, it was like, okay,
and this
a
is not Sai literature.
These were not necessarily Sai literature. They would be... You know, in the United States, they have a whole genre of literature that they call metaphysical or New Age of that. And it's not really, because they're principles that if you look, go, I think, and I've done a lot of study on this, clear back to the teachings of the Vedas. They've just tried to update that. So that's where Swami's name would appear, you know, and it always kind of catch me, you know. And I was like, if there's anything that you need, just... Ask Sai Baba. Well, I started developing this amazing relationship way before I physically came, you know, to see Swami's form. It was a continuation of my love for God. And what actually happened was that as a child, my child concept of God was actually formless. Mm-hmm. It was like love, and it was caring. It was the message of compassion and, you know, love your neighbor as yourself that Jesus had taught. It was all those things. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't really a form. But what happened for me was that, and particularly when I had my first darshan, it was all of that love, all of that feeling for God, all of that connection, all of that knowing that the universe is an amazing, beautiful gift of the Creator sort of landed on Swami's form, you know? And so I then went, wow, you can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
You know? It is such a grace.
So
and I'm so thankful.
It?
When I finally came to Puda Party for Darshan, was absolutely perfect. It was the month of December in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I just had the most fantastic time. I sang in the Christmas choir. I was in the play based on The Wizard of Oz, and I was actually a voiceover for the Wicked Witch. And I have to tell you, shrieking and screaming and doing all these things with the Lord sitting right behind you, and he was literally, was very interesting. And many years later, I still had people come up to me and say, I know you. You are the voice of the Wicked Witch. And so it was just, you know, Swami was very available physically then, and he'd come out, you know, during play practice, and one time I was finished with my lines, and it was so beautiful. You know, he was sitting there, and he was quite close up on the stage, and I was right there at the base of the stage, and I was going like this, and he was kind of going like this, and then our eyes met, and he just looked and looked, and I'm not sure what all happened during that time, but oh my God, the bliss, the knowingness, the connection to all that is was so strong that I said, oh, thank you, Lord. I don't have any more lines to say, because after play practice, and it was very intense for 2 weeks, we had a professional director from California putting this play together. I went back to my room and I just collapsed on my bed and I fell asleep. You know, I think I had to sleep with whatever had happened. So that was my first trip with a group of nine to India. Now, the story doesn't stop there, because we had double-checked with the airlines that all nine of us were actually confirmed to be on the plane to go back to the United States. Yes, you know, everybody's confirmed. So we get to the airport, and they go through the list, and they come to me, and they say, sorry, Karen, your name doesn't even appear on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So guess what? They didn't let me on the plane, and the rest of the group went back to the United States. And remember, this is in 99 when they weren't sure what was going to happen when 2000
yes.
rolled over. And I went, oh, Swami, here I am, my first time to India. I'm by myself. But you know what I did? I, New Year's Eve, I went to a beautiful Catholic cathedral and had
in
mass.
In the city, I guess?
Yes.
In Bangalore?
My taxi driver, you know what he said, Karen? He said, I just had the feeling that I should stay around. And so I come out of the airport, and I have to admit, I was upset. This was my first time traveling, you know, abroad, particularly by myself. Mm-hmm. And so he helped me for the entire week, and their family has since become a very dear family of mine, mm-hmm. friends of mine. So I stayed there for an extra 10 days.
In Bangalore?
In Bangalore, mm-hmm. yeah. And I kept going. He said, you have to go to that airline and just sit there till they let you on. And at one point I said, help, help. I'm a Christian minister. I have to get back to my congregation. And so I don't know what happened. For a plane that they kept telling me didn't have any seats, all of a sudden it had a seat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I truly believe in my heart that Swami wanted me to stay back for some reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I think part of that was for whatever needed to unfold in the church. I think the other thing was, since, you know, December of 99, I've been here 13 times. And I think part of it was to just show me that, you know, with the Lord, nothing's impossible. You can travel all over the world. You can meet any kind of circumstance, mm-hmm. which is what I had to face, mm-hmm. you know.
If I may just backtrack yes. a little, you know, from 1975, when you first had the realization about God's presence on earth,
yes.
till you met him in 1999. So for 24 years of your life, you went through this whole cycle of marriage, motherhood, going back to theology school, and
yes.
then serving your congregation as a minister.
Mm-hmm.
How did Swami's presence or knowing of his presence impact you as a person? How did it impact you as a minister, for instance?
The way it impacted me as a person was, I remember reading somewhere, why fear when I am here?
Mm-hmm.
And I had such a sin string all that time that, oh my gosh, there really is no reason to fear anything. I mean, God is actually here. The very God that I stand up every Sunday, whether I was at the church, and also during this time, I met many, many people as a chaplain in 3 or 4 hospitals, and mm-hmm. I always had to find a way to connect with them regardless of where they were coming from spiritually. You know, many times pray on the spot. And it was this constant awareness that Swami's presence, even though I hadn't been to Puja Party, was there as this incredible, what I called God, that had always lived, you know, in my life. And so it was like there was an extra strength mm-hmm. that was there to meet some difficult situations. It's not easy to be a hospital chaplain when people come in and there've been, you know, horrendous accidents, and you have to soothe the family and keep order and run back and forth between the doctor and the family, and is the patient alive, is the patient dead, you know, all those kinds of things. And so it was this gradual knowingness inside of me of the God's power and God's strength that, you know, had resided in me. And I think also it started to help make more sense of what Jesus had said. And I was just actually reading about it a couple nights ago. You know, first he said he was a messenger of God. Then he said he was a son of God. And then finally he said the Father and I are one. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was growing stronger in that when Jesus said he was first the servant of God, and then he was the son of God, and then he and God were one. That same process, even though I hadn't actually been to Puja Party to see the form yet, was growing in me. You know, first I'm like a servant, and then I'm the daughter, and then there is no difference. You know, God and I are one.
How did that go with the church? Were you able to articulate that, express that feeling, or the experience of this empowerment from within, divine empowerment?
I was able to express, because when I was finally asked to leave the church, there were two things that were said. They said, Karen, even though we can't commit to you anymore as a minister because of where you've been and what you now proclaim to believe, what we do know and what we do understand is your love for God. Regardless of what you say, that love just comes through all the time. And we respect that. And we admire that. But I could say, as the Bible says, you are made in the image of God. But to take that other step, like Swami has said, you know, you say, I'm God, and then he points back to the person and says, but you're God too. That was like heresy. To say, well, I'm also God, and you're also God. Because then there would be no more gap between all that is, the one, the universe, and the individual self. I don't think that God was a person with a beard that sat up on a cloud somewhere, but I think for a lot of Christians, that's a very huge theological jump to make. And I have to be honest with you that during this time, I had such, in my own personal way, close experiences with Jesus. I mean, Jesus was my best friend. I never saw him per se as God, but I certainly saw him as one who was so loving and, you know, gave his life, you know, for the betterment of humanity, that there were times when after I came here to see Swami, I felt a little bit of dissonance between my love for Jesus and now my love for this other form called Sai Baba.
And how did you resolve it?
With a lot of prayer, with realizing that the way I could conceptualize it was that for me, and Swami always has been from that very moment that I saw him, he was the one that sent Christ. He was God. He was a creator. I didn't know the word Brahman growing up, but I certainly knew creator, Lord, God, that makes us who we are, love, compassion, peace, you know, service, all of that. So the way I resolved it was that Swami, for me, his incarnated form, represented all that is, the all-knowing, the all-powerful, the all-present, that which exists. You know, we can't really give names or describe this. Swami's even said that.
And that's why in the Vedas it's referred to as that.
That.
Because there's no way, no other way to describe it.
Right. You know, I am that. Those types of things. So that's who Swami's form represents for me. And Jesus was the one that Swami sent to as a master, as a great prophet, as a great teacher, who went through these steps that Swami talks about, from servant to, you know, son or daughter of God, to actually knowing, realizing that I am that I am, that I am God. And then I found a very powerful book here called The Teachings of Sai Baba and Jesus. And I went through, and I realized that they were saying the same thing. And so until I was fired from the church, what I would do on a Sunday was, when I was preparing my speeches, I would look at these and I would go, okay. And oftentimes I would just kind of state what Swami had said, because it was what Jesus was saying.
Yeah, it just resonated the same.
And of course I didn't have to tell the congregation, there was no need, because there is only one.
Because the truth is the same.
The truth is the same. But for me, I think emotionally and personally, that book helped me to see that there is only one, that there is no difference, that Jesus, you know, I could still intensely love Jesus, which I do, and intensely have some amazing personal experiences of his awareness, and at the same time go, wow, what a blessing to be living at the time of the Pune Avatar, Sri Satya Sai Baba, and what he's done in my life. You know, it's like, this is absolutely incredible.
All right, so when you came here for the first time in the December of 1999, and you returned after your first ever trip to Prashanthi Nilayam, when you went back to your congregation, what did you tell them?
That first time, I told them I was on vacation in India. I didn't give them the precise details, because I actually did have vacation time. So now that I'm thinking back, that was okay with them. I was in vacation in India.
Okay.
And then I waited for a year, and I had vacation time again.
A year later.
A year later, and it was like I couldn't wait to get back here to see the Lord's form. So I think I took 2 or 3 weeks. I had basically a month's vacation. And so I came here, and this was the first time that I physically talked to Sai Baba and also offered him a letter. And that was very interesting, and I think it was part of the way it was supposed to play out. One of my friends, he said, you know, Karen, he said, I just have this feeling that you're not meant to leave when the group leaves. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, for me, the only way I can, you know, even pay any attention to that, is the only way I know how to communicate with Swami is to write him a letter. And in the letter I said, Dear Lord, I said, if you really want me to stay, and I don't know how else to do this, you know, I've been praying or whatever, this is a serious thing for me, then you will receive the letter, and that tells me that you really in fact do want me to not go back with the group again. And so sure enough, in Whitefield, I end up in the first row, and Swami comes down. He actually went all the way over to the men and then made a special backtracking, came down one of the exit aisles that I was sitting in, and he stopped and he took my letter. And he wanted to know, you know, how are you, where you're from, you know, those questions that he typically asks. And I just melted away, you know. I was gone in bliss. But for me, that was him saying, you know, Karen, I need you to stay a little bit longer. And so I did. I stayed for Sri Ratri, and then I left.
So you basically, your holidays were over, and you can extend
them. No, I had another week left.
Okay.
So I'll never forget, I called the church secretary. It wasn't that I didn't stay in communication, and I had another week left of vacation. I said, and these were the words that came out of my mouth. I didn't put them there. I'm absolutely sure of that. I called her up and I said, oh, by the way, I need to extend my vacation for a little bit longer. God has told me to stay here a little longer. And there is this absolute dead silence.
At the other end.
At the other end of the line. And I hung up and I said, oh, my God, Swami, what did I just say? So I stayed for Sri Ratri, and that was beautiful because I did see the lingam come out. And then I said, okay, Lord, my time's up. I'm going to head back. Well, during that time period, and after my con, what I said to the secretary, by the time I got back to the church, and then I developed a bad cold, so I actually ended up being gone for 5 weeks instead of 4 weeks, and I go back. And the board said, Karen, we have to speak with you. I said, okay. Here's the letter, Karen. You are no longer fit to be our minister, and we're going to start the proceedings to fire you.
And did they give you their reasons for doing so?
Mm-hmm. They thought that I had betrayed them by not coming back, you know. And I said, do you really want to know the truth of where I go and why I didn't come back? And I said, I know that God has reincarnated on the planet in the form of Sri Satya Sai Baba. He lives in India, and the last two trips I've been there to see him. I believe in my heart of hearts, for some reason he asked me to extend my stay a little bit longer, and that's what I did. Again, you could have heard a pin drop in this. Here's me, the only woman, with a whole church board of men, after I made this comment. And they said, well, Karen, that's great, but we still feel you're not fit to be our minister. So I said, okay, it's a long process to fire a minister, and it's very painful for everybody involved. I said, this is what I'm going to do. I will just go ahead and resign because you do not want me to be your minister, and I'm very willing to conduct services through Easter because it was coming up, you know, close to that time. And then I'll be happy to be finished, you know, after Easter Sunday. And they said, fine. Then they said, and this surprised me, but again, I know it was the Lord working. They said, we want you to tell the entire church what you just told us. Hmm. So I did. I got up one Sunday and I told them everything about Swami. I started out by explaining his teachings, the great social justice works that he's done, his care for the poor, how he has, who will ever know the number of people he's personally helped that we will never hear about it. And the intensity of the love of being with him, that love just oozes, and when you're around that love, you just want more of it. Mm-hmm. And you want to be that. So I explained all of that to the congregation. Again, I saw people sitting there with their mouths open. Mm-hmm. It was dead silence. And so I finished the service, and I went to the end of the church, and I always shook people's hands. Mm. And these three beautiful older women came up, and one of them said, Karen, If the Lord had told me to stay, I would have too. And so I think that helped a little bit because there was pain in it, you know, because I did love the people. And I think there were many people that loved me. It almost split the church in half because of the situation.
So then you gave your final speech,
yes,
a service.
Yes.
Those parting words, which were very powerful and obviously quite shocking to some of them. How did the congregation react? Did you find people come up and talk to you later, or did they nod their heads in disbelief and walk away from you?
Some of the people came up and talked to me because they'd always, I would say the ones that had initially been very supportive of me being there. And some of them shook their heads in disbelief, actually walked out of the door with their heads down and wouldn't even look at me. And some of them came by, shook my hand, and said, thank you. I don't know what to do. I can't place, I have nowhere to hang this message that you have just said, but I do really, I do respect you, but I agree you are not the right person for us.
I see. And when you were addressing this board that decided upon your dismissal, when you told them about where you have been and about God being on earth, were they familiar with Baba's name?
No. They had never heard of his name. I think the only people, there was one minister who used to come. We would have a group of ministers get together. I represented the Congregational Church. There was a Methodist minister, a First Christian minister, the Catholic priest would come. There was maybe a Lutheran person there. One of the ministers had heard about, had heard the name Sai Baba. And I think later he had shared with me, he had had some thoughts of maybe actually going and, quote, checking this out. But where I was a very conservative community. And, you know, the name Sai Baba, nobody had heard of except, I think, that one minister. So it was a brand new...
It's a real right-wing belt of the U.S.
That particular church... I would say yes, because
and the community as well.
Right, because today, if you were to go to some of the other congregational churches or the denomination, the United Church of Christ, and mention Sai Baba's name, I think it would be different. I think there would be people. These would be in the very liberal. This denomination is either ultra conservative or very liberal. And that's part of what they like, because the polity of the church or the politics is that each denomination picks their own minister. They're not appointed and sort of decides, you know, the rules and regulations of how they're going to govern the church.
Clearly your congregation was very Republican in its outlook. And
yes, yes. They were completely taken back, you know, by what had happened. And I think the thought, see, I think for Christians that I have met, for them, God could have only incarnated once, and that was Jesus Christ.
But
and that was the end of it.
Scriptures do speak of the second coming, don't they?
They do. They do speak of the second coming.
And how does the church interpret that?
I think the church interprets that in many ways. There are still Christians, I feel, who are waiting for the second coming. And they believe that it's going to actually be a form that's going to look like Jesus Christ. And when he comes, all those souls that have been faithful to God, have particularly been faithful to Jesus, he will sort of scoop up in his arms and take him to some heaven. See, I think there's one quote in the Bible which, whether it's really accurate or not, is what a lot of Christians have a stumbling block, and that is the only way to the Father is through me. And Jesus is purported to have said that. So, you know, even my family, who are Protestant and Catholic, we really don't have a lot of discussions this way, because I think they find it very upsetting, because they really believe that Jesus is the only way to Father. So they are waiting for, some people think, you know, that it's going to happen in the very near future. You know, some people think it's going to be a few thousand years away that Christ will return. Those, I would say, who are more attuned with metaphysical and certainly Swami's teachings see Swami as the cosmic Christ. They would use that term because Jesus was the name for the physical form. Christ is a term to denote the entirety of the Godhead, of the Creator, of all of that. And I think particularly when Swami said, I sent Jesus, and something to the fact when Jesus pointed to the Lamb and said, Baba, and Swami said that Baba was referring to this Baba, that for many people like me who have grown up Christian and know about Sai Baba, it makes perfect sense, you know, and they would see Swami as the cosmic Christ, as, you know, again, all that is, to the degree that you can put any words to that. And I think the best word for me, you know, would be love. So there's this huge gamut, you know. I think there are some Christians who see Sai Baba as an antichrist or something. I mean, I've run into them. And they want to persecute people who say that God is on the planet again or the cosmic Christ.
How do you deal with those people?
First of all, I pray. And I go, Lord, let me not condemn or judge. Let me see that they are probably where they need to be in their spiritual beliefs, that you have created both dark and light, that everything is the one, and I will just listen to them, and I will then say, do you want to hear my opinion or my thoughts on this? And if they say no, I say, fine, you know, God bless you. Because I have those kinds of people coming to my door with pamphlets and, you know, all these types of things. And when they find out I'm a minister, again, there's this sort of silence, you know, and they want to really quick show me what all they have, you know. And then I've often stepped outside on my doorstep and had some wonderful conversations. You know, so I just say, Lord, you're in charge of things, and I don't understand why people have to think these things about, you know, you being, you know, it actually hurts me when I hear people think like those things about Swami, because I love the form so much and the formless that it's just kind of like getting pierced in the heart when people have said the things about Sai Baba.
But I guess that's where your training as a minister comes in handy, that you're able to accept and let them be, because that is their place in their own journey. Everybody is on their own spiritual journey, and they are at a different place than you. And the fact that you can still pray for them and bless them, I guess that's an outcome of theology college and years of being a minister and loving Jesus.
I think very much so. And you know, Swami once told me, and it really helped a lot, and I've always known this because I do have family and friends and everything back in the United States, but I've always believed that part of the reason that he had me be trained as a minister was, first of all, because of my love and connection to God. I mean, I see absolutely no difference. I really do feel the oneness and the I-ness and I am, and I could use all the Vedic terms and then go back to the Christian terms or the Islamic terms. And I've spent a lot of time studying, you know, the the connections between the world religions. And I think it's all been preparation for me to be able to do what he said to me one day. He said, Karen, he said, your work is in America. And I think it's to help, because it has been a country that's tried to be open to different religious viewpoints, although, you know, there have been some strange things happening lately where people are not abiding by that. So, yes, I do feel, I've worked very hard at it, though, to have the compassion and the love and hopefully the acceptance.
Well, seeing that you have sort of come to this realization and risen over the past, I just have to ask you this for the interest of our listeners and for my own curiosity. When you were let go from the church, was it hard?
Yes, it was hard. It was hard from that particular church. It was difficult because I had to deal with, I think, some feelings of ego, which would be an advocacy. Oh, wow, I've really done something wrong. I've hurt these people. I've let them down, you know, but I couldn't have done it anyway because, you know, Swami, I just recently read in one of the letters he wrote to somebody, he said, enjoy every moment of your life, but have your priorities. And God is my priority. Mm-hmm. And everybody and my friends and family know that. So I would have done the same thing all over again.
So no regrets.
I have absolutely no regrets because I feel that the Lord wants me. In fact, he's kind of laid out five things for me to do. And one of them was, he said, I want you to teach people about God like mother. Those were his words, verbatim. And I said, okay, Lord, I've been working on that. Mm-hmm. But I think within the confines of just a Christian denomination that can't accept any other path other than Jesus, I would be not living from my dharmic satya truth, because that's not where I am, and I would not be doing justice to those people. Now, what I do miss is that ever since then, Swami's been working very hard on me to purify, to see everything. Everything is God, to love it, to bless, you know, whether it's this mic or the tumbler, and I love it when he says, this mic, and he says it in English, is God. You know, I'm really, really working on that. But I don't have the official, outside of the Sai Baba Center, because I have been a member of the Sai Baba Center.
In Colorado?
Church, yeah, in
Denver.
Colorado. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't had an official, should I say, platform, I'm not sure what word to use, where I can just stand up and freely speak about the unity of all religions. Because even the churches that are there, they sort of somehow start to narrow, and it feels very Christian in a way, although they speak about these other religious forms and acknowledge that. And so I've
that open-mindedness is conspicuous by its absence, I guess.
The open-mindedness is there, but in not very many people.
Yes.
It's very small, and I think that's why the Lord said your work is in America.
So now that you know, you just said that you can see the parallels between the Holy Quran, the Sacred Vedas, the Holy Bible, there is no difference. I have two hypothetical questions for
yes.
you. Reverend Karen, if you were to have an audience with His Holiness the Pope in Vatican today, what would you possibly say to him?
What would I possibly say to him? I would thank him for being willing to be a spiritual leader for a very large Christian group of people, because personally I know how difficult that can be. There are always factions. There are always people that want to get rid of you, maybe, people who don't like what you say, who disagree with your policies.
But the Pope's tenure is for the life.
Yes, right. But I believe that he still has to have discussions with his cardinals, and he still has to question his faith and his belief with God.
So you would thank him for dealing with
that? I would thank him for dealing with that, first of all. And then I would say, if you have a few minutes, may I speak my truth? And I would just outright say, you know, this may be a little interesting to hear. I use the word interesting a lot because it seems to not rub people the wrong way. But the God that you and I both worship has taken form again and is on the planet. Has come, if you want to call him as the cosmic Christ, that would certainly work. I don't care what terminology you need, but that form, that love, that teaching to bring humanity together, because I think the Pope is The Pope doesn't like all this war and killing and terrorists and all that any more than anybody else does. But what I've learned in the last 10 years is I'm going to speak my truth, and I'm going to tell people about Swami.
Including the Pope.
Including the Pope. I would say that to him. Yes, I would.
Okay, so to borrow your terminology, very interesting. Now, if you had an opportunity to speak to Bhagwan Sri Satyasai Baba, have a quick audience with him,
yes.
What would you say to him?
What would I say to him? Well, I did have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. During an interview?
I will call it an interview. It was when I had written the book, Soul Fire, Soul Desire. The last thing I had to do to get acceptance in the bookstore, because I donated the book, the copyright, everything else, I said, Lord, this is for you. You wrote the book. I want to give it back to you. For physical Swami, I had to write a letter. I was directed by the trust, and hand it to Swami. Okay? So I'm in Kodai Canal, and Swami comes around in his little cart, and he goes like that. He points right at me, and I'm right there. And he's on one side of the rail, and I'm on one side of the other. So I start talking to him. I looked him right in the eye, and I said, Swami, I love you so much. And he looked back at me, and I think that probably said it all. And anything else that might have been a peripheral question.
But for you, nothing else mattered. Just expressing your love to him.
Just expressing my love to him was the most important thing. That's what I had said all those years. If I get an opportunity with your physical form, I just want to look in your eyes and say, Swami, I love you. And that's what I did. And, of course, we were outside. There were thousands of people sitting there as this conversation, you know, is going on. And then, out of nowhere, his hand whips up like this, and he starts going around like this. And I'm so close, and I can see the gold, looked like gold beads, coming out of his hand like this.
From the palm.
From his palm. I mean, I was this eye close
level.
To his palm. Eye level, eye mm-hmm. level. I could see them. And then he asked me to put my hand out, and I did. And then he put it in my hand, and then the gold chain. And then right there in thousands of people in Darshan, he said, put on. And then he said, pendant, because I had just previously bought a pendant of
okay.
him. I'm standing in Darshan with all these people, not even believing what had happened, shaking so bad like a leaf. And I said, dear Lord, I said, I'm shaking so hard, I can't do this. And he laughed and he smiled. He looked at me. He says, oh, go sit down.
So he gave you, was it a japmala or did
he
a chain?
He gave me this
chain.
Gold chain.
Okay.
Yeah. There was love coming out there and the love in his eyes and just the absolute pure shock. Never in a million years. I'd never ever said, Swami, I want something from you. It had always been, what can I do for you? And so when that happened, you know, it was just amazing. And it was, so my friend came up to me after, she said, Karen, I think you had your interview.
So was it, did it feel like an affirmation of your spiritual yearning since your childhood all come together in that one moment?
Yes. Yes, it was like, oh my God, I could die right here on the spot. Because see,
and
when
you would be headed to the pearly gates.
I would be headed for the pearly gates or whatever, because I have to tell you, my very first trip, was it the first trip or second trip? No, the first trip was a Christmas trip, and I was so busy, it's a good thing I wasn't where I was the second or third trip. When I came, was it the second trip? I remember it. There have been so many trips. There's been 13 of them since, you know, almost 2000. And I looked at Swami one day in the Darshan Hall, and I said, Lord, I said, this is what I really want. I didn't know what I was asking for, to be honest, but, and he has obliged so sweetly. I said, Lord, I said, I want to be completely self-realized in this lifetime. I want to merge in you, and when this body goes, you know, I'm merged in you, whatever that means, and I'm not really sure. And then I said, and you do whatever it takes.
And he's been busy ever since.
And he has been busy ever since. And I meant that with all my heart, because there is nothing more important I know you had asked what does Bhagavan Sri Satya Sai Baba mean to me. Absolutely everything. My breath, my life, my motivation. He's what I live for. God, you know, being that God self. And it has been an amazing journey. And I would just say to the audience, if you're not on a spiritual path, find one. Because all these other things that you know, your work, your relationships, the money, those things, yes, we need them to take care of the body till it drops. But there is absolutely nothing, nothing, and I have been in that space, I think, almost most of my life, that compares to bliss, which is peace, which is joy, which is happiness. And not only intellectually knowing God, but having a personal relationship. And I have a very, very deep, strong personal relationship with the form and the formless.
Thank you for those very profound thoughts, Reverend Karen Chenoweth. It's been a pleasure to have had you and very, very enlightening to listen to you.
Thank you very much. And again, my love and thanks to Radio Sai and, of course, to our dear Lord. Thank you. Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Sai Ram and welcome back. Coming up on Morning Glory, part 3 of the interview with Sai University alumnus, Mr. Madhav Srimad Bhagavatam. He is in conversation with Radio Sai's Mr. Bishuprushti.
So after these days in Tirupati, you moved on to the U.S.
Yeah, after 95 is when I finished my engineering and I came and asked Swami for blessings if I can continue my studies in engineering in the United States. At that time, I had already gone through several books which were all published by professors at MIT or Carnegie Mellon or all the universities in the United States. And a seed was planted in my mind after the 4 years of engineering that I should study computer science in the U.S. because that's where the real innovation had happened in those early days of computer science, and it'd be nice to learn from the source. And then so I had that genuine interest for learning, and so I had asked Swami, I want to study further. And Swami blessed me, and Swami said, Tapakunda, definitely you go for the visa and you'll get the visa, you go for... Not many people actually attempted to go, but out of the 6 or 7 of my classmates who attempted to get the visa and go, I was the only one who actually got the visa first attempt.
His grace.
Totally His grace. And then so I went to University of South Carolina in 95. It was a little bit hard for me there, being one of the fewer Indians. It's a state, in at least in 95, where not many Indians or Asians were there. And so effect of that was that not many Sai centers or anything like that. So it used to be that I was pretty much praying to Swami, doing my own personal devotional sessions with Him. And a lot of challenging times initially because I didn't have an assistantship when I went there. And I had to pay a lot of tuition. But I actually didn't have to pay even a single penny from day one. But I went 2 weeks before. And in those 2 weeks, miraculously, the director of computer science department, Dr. Matthews, I approached him and I said, sir, this is what I'd like to try for some assistantship on campus. And again, Swami's blessings, as He promised me that He'll be with me, He took care of that. In the department came up with assistantships for 3 people. And there were 14 of us applying for it. I didn't know that, so I was initially excited that there were 3 positions. I had hope. But when I came to know there were 14 of us, and out of the 14, probably 12 of them were Indians, I thought it'll be very tough, steep competition to get it. So I kind of was despair, but I said, let me, as Swami had always prepared us, you have to do your best. So I prepared a presentation and whatever I can teach. We had to teach a class to the professors. That was the test. And I honestly should say that I was not that strong in some of the fundamental concepts of computer science, but those 2 weeks time I put my heart and soul into it and did whatever I can. put together a few slides, overhead projector in those days actually. No PowerPoint, at least. We didn't use one. And I made slides and I took it and I presented, and the professor was so happy. He said, "What a beautiful presentation. Very nicely done." All the credit goes to Bhagwan. Just can't imagine doing something like that ball by myself. And then I got the assistantship, and all the money I borrowed from the bank in India, I had sent it back day one. That's a nice experience I wanted to share on how Swami, when he says, "I'm with you, in you, around you," he's literally there. It's only our reaching out.
Amazing. He was there all the time. And I heard that Swami even performed your marriage.
Yes, so in 95 I'd gone to US, and in 96 December I'd come to India. By the time my parents started looking for matches, and they found few matches that they wanted to take to Swami, and shortlisted matches, I would say. But they eventually ended up with one girl who was a long time connection for my father. My father had studied Sanskrit from a guru called Varadacharya in Machilipatnam, who was my father's guru. But that person's granddaughter was studying in Sri Venkateshwar University, and somehow that connection established. Divine, yes. Cosmic incidents. And so my father and mother, they took her profile and pictures, and they took to Swami, and Swami said, I know her. She is your guru's granddaughter.
Swami said that. Beautiful.
It's a very good match, and go ahead. So then I came to India in December, and then I got the engagement done. And I came to Patti, and I was sitting in the alumni section, and I so vividly remember Swami doing this. Swami was coming from the ladies' side, and near the circle, there used to be a circle then in the middle. Near the circle, he didn't completely go towards the men's darshan. He cut diagonally, came walking to me, and he created vibhuti and put it in my hand. My mother was a little bit not doing well at that time, so he said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of your mother." And then immediately he pointed a finger at me and his forefinger, and said, "You're not doing the right thing. You got engaged and you're not getting married, and you're now leaving to USA. That's not right. The girl will be here waiting for you. Why don't you get married and go?"
Oh.
I mean, we didn't tell him anything about anything. Got his permission, but...
you had not told him about
nothing,
the engagement.
Nothing. I said, "Swami, I didn't finish my master's thesis, and that's the only reason. I want to go finish my master's thesis, and once I complete it and submit it, I'll be done with my education so I can get married. Then that was my plan, Swami, please." And Swami said, "Okay." Immediately he melted down. Said, "Santosham, go ahead, finish your MS thesis and then get married." So I went back. And then 98 January, I came to India again. Coming back to your point, Swami promised that he'll perform our wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So in 98, January 26th, we came. And 21st February was the Muhurtam, the auspicious occasion the priests have set for. February 1st, they wanted the marriage to be performed in her hometown, girl's hometown. But we came 4-5 days before, so we can have Swami perform marriage there, and then traditionally they can do what they want to do from the girl side. So 26th, when we came, Swami spoke to my dad, and Swami said, "Oh, you know, nowadays I'm not performing weddings," and he tried to play with us a little bit, you know, Krishna, typical. And then we kept praying, but after two or three darshans, finally Swami called us for interview, and in the interview, as we went and sat, Swami asked us both to come. We were next to Swami on either side, and then he took a photograph. One small, beautiful anecdote or experience I want to share is the divine photographer. My brother-in-law was seeing Swami for the first time, and he was tense, like beyond. And we asked him to take the picture of all. And he was fiddling with the camera. It's a new camera, and he didn't know where the flash, this, that. And Swami, the first time operating camera, Swami asked him. And then he took the picture, both of us on either side, me and my wife, to be wife, fiancé. And Swami said, "No, take another picture."
Mm-hmm.
There was a roll, no digital camera then.
Yes.
So it was roll thing. So after developing, we see why. After we developed the pictures, the first picture, both of us were with eyes closed, didn't come out that good. The second picture, we were, you know.
So one,
very, yeah.
Really the photo perhaps you treasure.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a small thing that happened there. But then Swami created this yellow rice from his fingertips again. Mm-hmm. You know, he just went on showering them on both of us. For
amazing.
A few minutes, he chanted all these, the wedding mantras they
secret.
Chant. He chanted
yeah,
and he performed
chants.
The wedding. And in the wedding, see how Swami takes care of subtle things. My wife's family, they were not devotees necessarily. They were not, they knew of Swami, but they were not devotees. So Swami didn't want to disappoint anybody because they had their own thing for their daughter's wedding. They wanted to do this, that, and in their town and all that. So Swami didn't actually ask us to do the, you know, thread, tying the thread around the neck and all that. He didn't. Because a small thing happened where he created a ring and he asked my wife to put it on my finger and she did. And then he created this Mangalsutra, which they wear, the women wear in India, right, for wedding. And he was showing it to us and I was trying to grab it and tie it. Swami said, "Oi, what is this hurry?" No. You do it according to how your in-laws have planned. You do it in their hometown. That is the date they have fixed. See how beautiful.
Amazing. I think Swami is making everyone happy.
Yeah. It's only
he's making you happy. They are new to Swami.
They're new to Swami.
So Swami is ensuring that, you know, there is nothing that should not happen which suddenly upsets them.
Upsets them, right.
Yes.
So that's how that
wonderful
happened.
Beautiful. So how was your days now in the US? Because I heard that, I know that you also were deeply involved in the SAI organization there.
Yeah.
And you were the young adult coordinator and the regional coordinator. And so one hand you had this and on the other hand you had your professional life.
Right. I had started in the SAI organization as a young adult coordinator in 2004. Until then I was part of the Boston SAI Center and I was participating in several activities. But I was also doing my master's at MIT until 2003. So, and while working a full-time job, so it was a little bit time crunch. So I couldn't take up anything, but I was definitely part of the organization in weekly activities. But in 2004, Swami gave me the opportunity to work with the young adults in Boston. It's a very vibrant group of young adults actually in Boston, and in a prior trip to India, Swami had personally told me, and that also made an impression on me, which in the interview room, Swami, my mother had told Swami, "Swami, he's in Boston and it's a very big city and all, he's driving, you only have to take care of him, Swami." Swami said, no, I don't worry about it. It's actually very easy to drive in Boston, Swami told. And he actually was showing how cars go and everything. If you pile up all the cars, they'll reach the sky. You don't know. I am always with him. Don't worry. And then he told me, sorry for the slight aside, but I just remembered this, that Swami told me, "You're going away, far away, not from me, from your parents. And you and your wife, you'll be alone by yourself. And I know you're very short-tempered." And I said, I didn't know I was short-tempered until then. Seriously, and I have to agree, of course, that I am short-tempered. But Swami revealed that to me of my own nature. When you go back to Boston, when you get angry, you have to see there are, on the road, when you're going in a car, you have speed bumps. Remember that, he said, he told me. When you get angry, put a speed bump. Don't react in harsh, in a fast manner. And that taught me some lesson. Several years in my married life, I've applied that principle. So I never try my best. I wouldn't want to claim that I am this perfect human being, which I'm far from. But several times when I do get angry at the family members, the very immediate thing that I remember is Swami telling me these words. Remember speed bumps.
Yes.
And so I immediately stop, put a break, and I slow down and I try my best not to react to the situation right away. But anyway, sorry for the sight. So in that, Swami told me, Swami said, I attend Boston SAI Center. Swami said, work with the young adults. He told me. He said, work with the young adults. and take whatever you have taken from the school here and see if you can share it with them. And there was almost a command to me, actually, from Swami. So that's how I went back. And then in 2004, when I got the opportunity, I grabbed it. I worked with the Boston Sai Youth for 2 years. We did several projects which were already ongoing, and I was instrumental in just being part of motivating a few of them to. But one thing that I, as I kept thinking about it, what was the transformation? Who really benefited from this? Was there some young adult that said, wow, you know, this is amazing? And then I eventually really figured out that the real transformation happened in me, actually, as a young adult leader. I thought I was going in there to change everybody and do something amazing, but actually I changed myself.
Yes, and that is the aim of service.
It was so beautiful to me to see that.
That is the aim of all, I think everything that we do in the Satyasai organization, be it bhajans or any spiritual activity or seva activity, I think that is the bottom line. What the activity does to you.
The activity does to you, as opposed to you do to others and the stuff like that. So I learned, you know, how to actually, you know, be part of the community and work with underprivileged homeless people or people who have no shelter in the winter, snowstorms. There were some amazing young adults who proposed the idea of not just, you know, giving money away or doing some distant service kind of thing. Let's actually get on the streets. Let's experience the cold like they would. Let's sit with them. Let's give them a coffee. Let's sit with them a warm hot Coke or some chocolate and give them a sandwich. Spend time with them. That's something I actually never did before. I never thought of service as that. But that to me was an eye-opener. As a young adult coordinator, when this proposal came, I immediately jumped on it and let's do it. So, and now, since 2004, this has become a practice in Boston. That every winter they do something called winter cloth drive. They collect, you know, coats and jackets and socks, and they gather everything in the bhajan. I mean, in the Sai Center, and then they prepare sandwiches. They prepare hot cocoa chocolate, hot chocolate. Then they actually 20, 30, 40 young adults. They get off in groups on the local train stations, and they go off in different directions by car or by walk. And then they talk to any stranger who is stranded on the streets without any shelter. They sit with them, give them a sandwich, you know, spend a couple of minutes talking to them about how they feel and can they get any help from them. And then serve the hot cocoa. And it's a very beautiful experience that young adults have taught me, actually. And then as a regional young adult coordinator, after the 2006, I got the opportunity to be the regional young adult coordinator. And what I learned from Swami was that Swami was always hands-on, and he was always on the job in the field as a leader. He used to, whether it was a drama or whether it was cleaning the stadium, he was there. He was literally there, right? And he led by example in that way, and he used to tell us how to do things, what to do. And so this way, I took that as a lesson. So when we started out as young adults, me and my counterpart, Purnima in Buffalo, both of us said, let's go around all the seven states and let's talk to all the young adults and let's see what kind of groups there are right now and how we can make the group more stronger and how we can make them feel that they're all part of this organization to do some service and get them inspired. So we went around on road, drove to several young adults, you know, groups. And that was wonderful. I mean, the one thing that I have to say, I think if at all a story, is that one or two young adults who actually came to us and had expressed that, you know, without this kind of a event, because the whole thing culminated in a one-day retreat for all the young adults in Boston. And they felt like something like that had never happened, and they never had the opportunity for somebody who was just one of the two young adults in a remote place in one of the states. They felt like this was such a beautiful experience for them to come interact with so many like-minded Sai young adults and to be able to experience that whole day and almost dive and immerse themselves in Swami. was amazing. So they wanted, so now actually they are continuing that also. The retreat happens every year.
And you came as a group to Prashanthanilayam?
And in 2008, we had come as a group, Northeast group, on a pilgrimage. And again, there was this art connection there, which I never imagined that it would happen. In 2008, when we came for 10 days. For the first 3-4 days, Swami didn't talk to our coordinators. We prepared everything, program and this and that. And then the coordinator, Mr. Ramesh Vadhwani uncle, yes. You might have met him. So he had asked a few of us to do, like, write letters and ask anyone to prepare, like, a greeting card. Because we didn't have anything to show Swami, I think, at the time. Like, we were asking him for permission. So then Murthy uncle, who was the regional president, he asked me, can you make a card? It's just amazing
you
that
made
I,
it
full
school
circle, full circle coming back. Yes. I used to make greeting cards for Swami in 10th class, 12th class.
Yes.
Immediately I said, just jumped up, what an opportunity.
Mm.
Immediately I ran into the streets and found a store where I can get the good material for the card and the pens, colors and whatnot.
Mm.
Went home before the darshan, I have to finish. It's time bound. And I made this beautiful, again, his inspiration.
Mm.
It's a heart-shaped greeting card.
Mm.
And then when Swami came that evening, he went to Ramesh Vadhwani uncle and he was holding this card. Swami asked him what is the program, and immediately Ramesh uncle presented this card to Swami. Swami took the card, read through the whole thing, and he was so happy. And he, he said, go ahead with the program in the evening or something like that. So we performed. And we also did a big exhibition in Purnachandra Auditorium on human values and other things.
Wonderful. So, you are having a lovely time in Boston, being the regional coordinator for young adults. Then, what happened in 2011? You decided to come back to India.
In 2008, as many Indians in India, the background processing goes on that maybe we want to go back to India, or should we not? The dilemma is always there, and so it was there in our minds also. And it's not an easy decision. If it was, then many would make it. So, and Swami made it easy for us. So in January, when we had visited India and we came to Patti for the Alumni Day,
January 1st, 2011,
for the first January 1st and 2nd, had wonderful darshans and Purnachandra Hall sessions with Swami. And almost all the alumni students went back on 2nd. And we also decided to go, but for some reason we thought we'll have one more darshan on the third morning and then we'll go back home. On third morning, we were asked to, before Swami came out, there was a news that all the students who were remaining alumni should go and sit in the mandir. And there were maybe 100, 150 only, students. So we all rushed inside and sat, and I actually was talking to another Professor Shah, who was a visiting faculty here actually, and suddenly he told me, hey, looks like Swami said something, all the students are running inside. I didn't realize. So I was almost one of the last ones to go in, and I was slightly disappointed. The only last chance I got, even that, I sat in the end near the Krishna thing, Gitopadesam. And Swami might come from the beginning, from the front, and he might sit in the front and he might go. And so I was very disappointed, but at the same time kept praying. And then Swami, as he came, they made lines for Swami's chair to come all through. So Swami actually started making down, he started talking to students. And then from Gita Padesam, while he was turning and coming back, I was sitting towards the end of there, and he immediately signed to the person pushing the chair. So he came directly and stopped in front of me. I was holding my two daughters' pictures, photographs, which was also totally unplanned. I just printed them before coming to darshan in front of the gate. Some random pictures. I would probably never present them to Swami. They didn't look good. They didn't come out good. But anyway, it's all Swami's will, right? So I was holding the picture. Swami saw the smile, full of smile. He saw the pictures and he just waited there. I put both the pictures on in his lap. I said, Swami, these are your children. And Swami still waited. And I told them their names, and so I told, suddenly this thought prompt popped in my mind, and I said, Swami, we want to come back to India.
You're not
like, it's totally left, you know, whatever, it just came. I mean, there was something subconsciously was going on, but this just came up, and the Swami said, Chala Santosham, very happy. And he asked me to take Pad Namaskar, he gave Vibhuti, he put it in my hand, and then he went away. And that was the turning point, I think, for us, so, at least in this decision.
Yeah, I think for you, fortunately, most of the important decisions of your life have been taken by the Divine. You didn't have to spend sleepless nights thinking about what to do. But let me ask you about some other dilemmas of life. Because, sure. You know, you were in the U.S. and how was it working in the corporate environment there, being a student? Because the environment out there has its own way of doing things, and you are trained in a particular manner. You have your own value systems and your principles that get ingrained in you once you're studying here. Was it really difficult practicing those values in the corporate environment there?
Definitely challenging, no question about it. But for example, when I was studying I had three other roommates in my apartment, and none of them knew about or necessarily believed. They knew about Swami, but they didn't believe. So I was by myself. I had Swami's picture, and I used to do my own and live my own life. And every Friday night, they used to have parties and lots of drinking and this and that. But I never felt the need to engage in those to be a friend. So I always thought of them as excellent friends. But they, at times, one or two times at least, they used to say, hey, what is this Sai Baba thing? What is all this? Put them all aside. Let's have fun. But I was reminded of something that Swami told us when the six of us as engineering students went into the interview room. Swami asked one of them, what is good? And he said, Swami, doing the right thing. And Swami asked, what is right? And none of us had a real answer for it. And Swami put his hand on his heart and said, what your conscience allows you to do, that is right. That is the right thing. And that's what you should do. So that's something that stuck with me. So whenever I got into such a situation, I always remembered that my conscience, if it says that I should go ahead and drink and have the party and involve in that, then I should probably do it. But I never felt it that way. I always felt that my conscience wouldn't allow me to do that. And so I didn't compromise on that. And they did make fun of me several times, but that didn't bother me. And that same thing continued in business as I started working there. I used to travel towards the later part of my career. I traveled quite a bit to my customer sites. And I was a technical project manager, product manager, that kind of. I did have interactions with the customers. And after the meetings, we used to all go out for dinner. And in those situations too, very similar temptation or a need for being one of them arises. And I clearly remember one occasion where my colleagues were ordering all kinds of alcoholic drinks, and I didn't have anything to drink there. There was not even sodas. And they started looking at me like I was an oddball out and making fun of me. I said, okay, I'll have some drink. And I asked that person in the bartender what's there. And he said, some pina colada. I said, can you make it without alcohol? And he said, yeah, we call it the virgin pina colada. I said, okay, I'll have that. And then they started laughing, the colleagues. And they said, oh, that's a girl's drink, you know, you're a girl. And I just didn't feel like reacting anything. I mean, it's okay. I have my principles and I have my self-confidence. Swami has taught me well enough to not have to compromise my values to have to get the deal or have to become one of the customers. You know, feel like when I'm also part of the customer's social habits. And it worked out very well, actually, because when I look back, my roommates as well as my colleagues, they appreciated me quite a bit. They looked at me very uniquely in the company as somebody who would not compromise. And that actually played a big part in how they treated me professionally, to either to promote me or to do anything. They thought, okay, this is a very high principled person, and we'll give some work to him. We can expect good quality out of it.
Fantastic. I think so in the short term, there are these challenges, but I think, and maybe sometimes even setbacks.
Setbacks too.
when you conform to your principles. But I think in the long run, you always stand to benefit, and you always see that that was the right decision you have taken. And as you mentioned, eventually you earn respect.
Like Swami always says, Satyam, the truth never changes, and truth will always win. Satyam okate, Satyam okate, Satyam okate. It will never, it might take time for everybody to realize the truth, but the truth will remain, right? And so when I stuck to my principles, and eventually it was not a one-time thing. There were several occasions. Even at work, Friday evenings, my boss and others used to get together in his room, and he had several alcoholic drinks right on his table. Hey, let's open up a bottle and let's chat about our next product on our drinks. And I used to just sit and have the discussion happily without drinking. And one of the colleagues passed a comment saying, you don't need to get high to make productive comments, I suppose, they said. I said, yeah, of course. It's amazing, actually. So
you're always on the high. Thanks to Swami.
Thanks to Swami.
He's raised us much higher.
Yeah.
I'm really reminded of what Swami told your parents, that I will make a diamond out of him. And I think in some ways he's been chiseling, and he's been protecting, and he's been ensuring that, you know, your personality is molded and shaped. And I think that is the experience of every student. Let me come back to my visit to your home. You said that you're interested in art and sports, but I saw a piano in your home. What was that doing there?
My daughter, actually, she learns piano. She has been learning since she was 4.5 years old in the U.S. And now she's 9.5, 10. And she's continuing to learn. But music is something that slowly slipped through into our house. After I lost my mom was very much into music. But although she never was trained, she loved to compose. She loved to sing. And she had a very beautiful voice. And she used to sing for Swami in the mandir, in the interview room sometimes. She used to just sing right in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt fascinated, but I always also thought maybe it's not something I like, or maybe it's not something I can do, whatever. I always didn't pay much attention. I always liked art and sports and those kind of things. But after my mother passed away, for some reason I felt like if I learn music and maybe I could sing and I could sort of divert myself away from this sadness in my life a little bit. So I took up Carnatic lessons in year 2001. And my guru, Srimati Aparna Balaji, she is a very accomplished Carnatic singer. And so I started training with her from basics. That's how...
That's interesting. So in 2001, you started Carnatic.
In the United States, I started Carnatic lessons. And I went on for a few years until 2010. I was learning from her.
Wonderful. So you learned singing.
I learned vocal from her, and my favorite raga was something that I didn't know, but my mother used to sing several songs in raga, Sindhu Bhairavi.
Wonderful. Yeah, Sindhu Bhairavi is such a raga where you can put in a lot of feeling.
Feeling.
Right? Why don't you sing for us? Maybe we'll end our conversation on that musical note.
Definitely. Actually, this is... As my mother used to sing a few songs, and I had asked my teacher, I just sang a couple of lines of one of the songs, and I asked her, because I didn't know enough about ragas and all that. And my teacher then pointed, oh, this is Sindhu Bhairavi. Oh, this is Sindhu Bhairavi. Oh, this is... And then I said, oh, my mother used to sing a lot of Sindhu Bhairavi.
You have Komal notes in that, right? Yes.
If I can, I'll just sing a small connection with Tirupati. Maybe I'll...
Sure.
Sai Venkateshwara. I'll
sure.
sing this Kriti... Venkatachalanilayam, which is in Sindhu Bhairavi.
Yes, sure.
Venkatachalanilayam Vaikuntha Puravasam. Venkatachalanilayam Vaikuntha Puravasam. Pankajanetram Paramapavitram. Pankajanetram Paramapavitram. Venkatachalanilayam Vaikuntha Puravasam. Pankajanetram Paramapavitram. Shankhachakradhara Chinmaya Rupam. Venkatachalanilayam Vaikuntha Puravasam. Ambujodbhava Vinutam Aganita Gunanamam. అంబుజోద్భవ వినుతం అగణిత గుణనామం తుంబురు నారద గాన విలోలం తుంబురు నారద గాన విలోలో వెంకటాచల నిలయం వైకుంఠపురవాసం మకర కుండల ధర మదన గోపాలం మకర కుండల ధర మదన గోపాలం తుంబురు నారద గాన విలోలం తుంబురు నారద గాన విలోలో వెంకటాచల నిలయం వైకుంఠపురవాసం మకర కుండల ధర మకర కుండల ధర మదన గోపాలం భక్త పోషక శ్రీ పురంధర విఠలం భక్త పోషక శ్రీ పురంధర విఠలం వెంకటాచల నిలయం వైకుంఠపురవాసం.
బ్యూటిఫుల్. Thank you very much, and thank you so much for also coming to the studio. And you know, it's almost nearly 2 hours that we have been talking. We didn't realize that, but it's really been wonderful, because I think each of these anecdotes are powerful ways of reinforcing for us what Swami means to each one of us. It is for us to now remember and ruminate on this, relive these moments, and ensure that we become little tiny lamps of love in his kingdom. And as he mentioned, we should become those little diamonds that Swami is preparing all of us to shine in his name, shine in his glory. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Sairam.
Sairam, and welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. The time right now in Prashanthi Nilayam, India is 11:08 a.m. And today is the 4th of April, 2013. Dear listeners, I owe you a small apology. Last week, when I played part 2 of this interview with Mr. Madhav Srimad Bhagavatam, I said it was the concluding part. Actually, it was not. The part that we played today, which is part 3, is the concluding part of this 3-part conversation. So if you're looking to hear the entire interview, you can go to our website, radiosci.org/sci-students, and look for this 3-part conversation with Mr. Madhav Srimad Bhagavatam. And I do look forward to your feedback to this conversation, as well as to the earlier interview with Reverend Kiran Chenoweth. As always, you can reach us by email at listener@radiosci.org. And now it's time for me to wind up Morning Glory. I've gone past my time and eaten up 10 minutes of my colleague Raghu's time. I would like to take this moment to offer my overextended hosting efforts at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Till we meet next Thursday, please be well, keep seeking, and do whatever it takes to stay inspired and focused on the positive. Sairam.